23. Gardner came to around sundown with a hangover headache and a feeling that things had happened which he could not quite remember.
Finally made it, guard, he thought. Finally had yourself another blackout. Satisfied.
He managed to get off the porch and to walk shakily around the corner of the house out of view of the road before throwing up. He saw blood in the vomit and wasn't surprised. This wasn't the first time, although there was more blood this time than ever before. Dreams. Christ, he'd had some weird nightmares, blackout or no. People out here coming and going, so many people that all they needed was a brass band and the Dallas...
Police. The Dallas police were out here this morning and you got drunk so you wouldn't see them, you fucking coward.
Cowgirls. Nightmares, that was all. He turned away from the puddle of puke between his feet. The world was wavering in and out of focus with every beat of his heart, and Gardner suddenly knew that he had edged very close to death. He was committing suicide after all, just doing it slowly. He put his arm against the side of the house and his forehead on his arm. "Mr. Gardner, are you all right?" "Huh?" he cried, jerking upright. His heart slammed two violent beats, stopped for what seemed forever, and then began to beat so rapidly he could barely distinguish the individual pulses. His headache suddenly cranked up to overload. He whirled. Bobby Tremaine stood there, looking surprised, even a little amused, but not really sorry for the scare he had given Gardner. "Gee, I didn't mean to creep up on you, Mr. Gardner."
"You fucking well did, and I fucking well know it."
The Tremaine kid blinked rapidly several times. He had caught some of that, Gardner saw. He found he didn't give a shit. "Where's Bobby?" he asked. I know who you are. I know where you are, right in front of me. Where's Bobby?" "Well, I'll tell you," Bobby Tremaine said. His face became very open, very wide-eyed, very honest, and Gardner was suddenly forcibly reminded of his teaching days. This was how students who had spent a long winter weekend skiing, screwing, and drinking looked when they started to explain that they couldn't turn in their research papers today because their mothers had died on Saturday. "Sure. Tell me." Gardner leaned against the clabbered side of the house, looking at the teenager in the reddish glow of sunset. Over his shoulder he could see the shed, padlocked, its windows boarded up. The shed had been in the dream, he remembered.
Dream, or whatever it is you don't want to admit was real.
For a moment the kid looked genuinely disconcerted by Gardner's cynical expression. "Miss Anderson had a sunstroke. Some of the men found her near the ship and took her to Dairy Home Hospital. You were passed out." Gardner straightened up quickly. "Is she all right?" "I don't know. They're still with her. No one has called here, not since 3 o'clock or so, anyway. That's when I got out here." Gardner pushed away from the building and started around the house, head down, working against the hangover. He had believed the kid was going to lie, and perhaps he had lied about the nature of what had happened about it. But Gardner sensed a core of truth in what the kid said. Bobby was sick, hurt, something. It explained those dreamlike comings and goings he remembered. He supposed Bobby had called them with her mind. Sure, called them with her mind, neatest trick of the week, only in Haven, ladies and germs. "Where are you going?" Tremaine asked, his voice suddenly very sharp.
"Derry."
Gardner had reached the head of the driveway. Bobby's pickup was parked there. The Tremaine kid's big yellow Dodge Challenger was pulled in next to it. Gardner turned back toward the kid. The sunset had painted harsh red highlights and black shadows on the boy's face, making him look like an Indian. Gardner took a closer look and realized he wasn't going anywhere. This kid with the fast car and the football hero shoulders hadn't been put out here just to give Guard the bad news as soon as Guard managed to throw off enough of the booze to rejoin the living.
"Am I supposed to believe Bobby was out there in the woods, excavating away like a madwoman, and she keeled over with a sunstroke while her sometime partner was lying back on the porch drunk as a coot? That it? Well, that's a good trick, because she was supposed to be at the McCausland woman's funeral. She went into the village, and I was out here alone, and I started thinking about what I saw Sunday. I started thinking, and then I started drinking, which is mostly the way it works with me." Of course, Bobby could have gone to the funeral, come back here, changed, gone out in the woods to work, and then had a sunstroke. Except that isn't what happened. The kid's lying. It's written all over his face. And all of a sudden, I'm very fucking glad he can't read my thoughts.
I think Miss Anderson would rather have you stay here and keep on with the work, Bobby Tremaine said evenly. You think? That is, we all think. The kid looked momentarily more disconcerted than ever, wary, a bit rocky on his feet.
Didn't expect Bobby's pet drunk to have any teeth or claws left, I guess.
That kicked off another much queerer thought, and he looked at the kid more closely in the light which was now fading into orange and ashy pink. Football hero shoulders, a handsome cleft-chinned face that might have been drawn by Alex Gordon or Bernie Wrightson. Deep chest, narrow waist. Bobby Tremaine, All-American. No wonder the Coulson girl was nuts over him. But that sunken, infirm-looking mouth went oddly with the rest, Gardner thought. They were the ones who kept losing teeth, not Gardner.
Okay, what's he here for? To guard me, to make sure I stay put, no matter what.
Well, all right, he said to Tremaine in a softer, more conciliatory voice. If that's what you all think. Tremaine relaxed a little. It really is. Well, let's go in and put on the coffee. I could use some. My head aches, and we'll have to get going early in the morning. He stopped and looked at Tremaine. You are going to help out, aren't you? That's part of it, isn't it? Yes, sir. Gardner nodded. He looked at the shed for a moment, and in the fading light he could see brilliant green tattooed in the small spaces between the boards. For a moment his dream shimmered almost within his grasp, deadly shoemakers hammering away at unknown devices in that green glare. He had never seen the glow as bright as this before, and he noticed that when Tremaine glanced in that direction, his eyes skittered away uneasily. The lyric of an old song floated, not quite randomly, into Gardner's mind and then out again.
Don't know what they're doing, but they laugh a lot behind the green door. Green door, what's that secret you're keeping?
And there was a sound. Faint. Rhythmic. Not at all identifiable, but somehow unpleasant. The two of them had faltered. Now Gardner moved on toward the house. Tremaine followed him gratefully. Good, Gardner said, as if the conversation had never lagged. I can use some help. Bobby figured we'd get down to some sort of hatchway in about 2 weeks, that we'd be able to get inside. Yes, I know, Tremaine said without hesitation. But that was with two of us working. Oh, there'll always be someone else with you, Tremaine said, and smiled openly. A chill rippled up Gardner's back. Oh. Yes, you bet. Until Bobby comes back. Until then, Tremaine agreed.
Except he doesn't think Bobby's going to be back. Ever.
Come on, he said. Coffee, then maybe some chow. Sounds good to me. They went inside, leaving the shed to churn and mutter to itself in the growing dark. As the sun disappeared, the stitching of green at the cracks grew brighter and brighter and brighter. A cricket hopped into the luminous pencil mark one of these cracks printed onto the ground and fell dead. Chapter 10. A Book of Days. The Town Concluded. 1. Thursday, July 28th. Butch Dugan woke up in his own bed in Derry at exactly 3:05 a.m. He pushed back the covers and swung his feet out onto the floor. His eyes were wide and dazed, his face puffy with sleep. The clothes he had worn on his trip to Haven with the old man the day before were on the chair by his small desk. There was a pen in the breast pocket of the shirt. He wanted that pen. This seemed to be the only thought his mind would clearly admit. He got up, went to the chair, took the pen, tossed the shirt on the floor, sat down, and then just sat for several moments, looking out into the darkness, waiting for the next thought. Butch had gone into Anderson's shed, but very little of him had come out. He seemed shrunken, lessened. He had no clear memories of anything. He could not have told a questioner his own middle name, and he did not at all remember being driven to the Haven-Troy town line in the Cherokee Hillman had rented, or sliding behind the wheel after Adley McKean got out and walked back to Kyle Archenborg's Cadillac. He likewise did not remember driving back to Derry. Yet all these things had happened. He had parked the Cherokee in front of the old man's apartment building, locked it, then got into his own car. 2 blocks away, he had stopped long enough to drop the Jeep keys into a sewer. He went directly to bed and had slept until the alarm clock planted in his mind woke him up. Now some new switch clicked over. Butch blinked once or twice, opened a drawer, and drew out a pad of paper. He wrote, "I told people Tuesday night I couldn't go to her funeral because I was sick. That was true. But it was not my stomach. I was going to ask her to marry me, but kept putting it off, afraid she'd say no. If I hadn't been scared, she might be alive now. With her dead, there doesn't seem to be anything to look forward to. I am sorry about this mess." He looked the note over for a moment, and then signed his name at the bottom. Anthony F. Dugan. He laid the pen and note aside and went back to sitting bolt upright and looking out the window. At last, another relay kicked over. The last relay. He got up and went to the closet. He ran the combination of the wall safe at the back and removed his .357 mag. He put the belt over his shoulder, went back to the desk, and sat down. He thought for a moment, frowning, then got up, turned off the light in the closet, shut the closet door, went back to the desk, sat down again, took the .357 from its holster, put the muzzle of the gun firmly against his left eyelid, and pulled the trigger. The chair toppled and hit the floor with a flat, undramatic wooden clap, the sound of a gallows trap door springing open. 2. Front page, Bangor Daily News, Friday, July 29th. Derry State Policeman Apparent Suicide. Was in charge of trooper disappearance investigation. By John Leandro. Corporal Anthony Butch Dugan of the Derry State Police Barracks apparently shot himself with his service revolver early Thursday morning. His death hit the Derry Barracks, which was rocked last week by the disappearance of 2 troopers, hard indeed. 3. Saturday, July 30th. Gardner sat on a stump in the woods, his shirt off, eating a tuna and egg sandwich and drinking iced coffee laced with brandy. Across from him, sitting on another stump, was John Enders, the school principal. Enders was not built for hard work, and although it was only noon, he looked hot and tired and almost fagged out. Gardner nodded toward him. "Not bad," he said. "Better than Tremaine, anyway. Tremaine had burned water trying to boil it." Enders smiled wanly. "Thank you." Gardner looked beyond him to the great circular shape jutting from the ground. The ditch kept widening, and they had to keep using more and more of that silvery netting, which somehow kept it from caving in. He had no idea how they made it, only knew that the large supply in the cellar had been almost depleted, and then yesterday a couple of women from town had come out in a van with a fresh supply, neatly folded like freshly ironed curtains. They needed more because they kept taking away more and more of the hillside, and still the thing continued down. Bobby's whole house could now have fit into its shadow. He looked at Enders again. Enders was looking at it with an expression of adoring religious awe, as if he were a rube druid, and this was his first trip from the boonies to see Stonehenge. Gardner got up, staggering slightly. "Come on," he said. "Let's do a little blasting." He and Bobby had reached a point weeks earlier where the ship was as tightly embedded in dour bedrock as a piece of steel and concrete. The bedrock hadn't hurt the ship, hadn't put so much as a scratch on its pearl-gray hull, let alone dented or crushed it. But it was tightly plugged. The plug had to be blasted away. It would have been a job for a construction crew who understood how to use dynamite, a lot of dynamite, under other circumstances. But there was explosive available in Haven these days that made dynamite obsolete. Gardner still wasn't clear on what the explosion in Haven Village had been, and wasn't sure he ever wanted to be clear on it. It was a moot point anyway, because no one was talking. Whatever it had been, he was sure that some huge piece of brickwork had taken off like a rocket, and some of those new and improved explosives had been involved. There had been a time, he remembered, when he had actually wasted time speculating on whether or not the super brain food Bobby's artifact was putting into the air could produce weapons. That time now seemed incredibly distant. That Jim Gardner, incredibly naive.
"Can you make it, Johnny?"
he asked the school principal. Enders got up, wincing, putting his hands in the small of his back. He looked desperately tired, but he managed a small smile just the same. Looking at the ship seemed to refresh him. Blood was trickling from the corner of one eye, however, a single red tear. Something in there had ruptured.
"It's being this close to the ship,"
Gard thought. On the first of the 2 days Bobby Tremaine had spent helping him, he had spit out his last few teeth like machine gun bullets almost as soon as they got here. He thought of telling Enders that something behind his right eye was leaking, then decided to let him discover it on his own. The guy would be all right. Probably. Even if he wasn't, Gardner wasn't sure he cared. This, more than anything else, shocked him.
"Why should it? Are you kidding yourself that these cats are human anymore? If you are, you better wise up, Gard old Gard."
He headed down the slope, stopping at the last stump before rocky soil gave way to chipped and runneled bedrock. He picked up a cheap transistor radio made of yellow, high-impact plastic. It looked like Snoopy. Attached to it was the board from a sharp calculator and, of course, batteries. Humming, Gardner made his way down to the edge of the trench. There, the music dried up, and he was quiet, only staring at the titanic gray flank of the ship. The view did not refresh him, but it did inspire a deep awe which had overtones of steadily darkening fear.
"But you still hope, too? You'd be a liar if you said you didn't. The key could still be here somewhere."
As the fear darkened, however, the hope did, too. Soon, he thought, it would be gone. The hillside excavation now made the ship's flank too far away to touch. Not that he wanted to. He didn't enjoy the sensation of having his head turning into a very large speaker. It hurt. He rarely bled now when he did touch it, and touching it was sometimes inevitable. But the blast of radio always came, and on occasion his nose or ears could still spray a hell of a lot more blood than he cared to look at. Gardner wondered briefly just how much borrowed time he was now living on, but that question was also moot. From the morning he had awakened on that New Hampshire breakwater, it had all been borrowed time. He was a sick man, and he knew it, but not too sick to appreciate the irony of the situation in which he found himself. After busting his hump to dig this fucker up with a variety of tools, which looked as if they might have come out of the Hugo Gernsback whole universe catalog, after doing what the rest of them probably couldn't have done without working themselves to death in a kind of hypnotic trance, he might not be able to go inside when and if they came to the hatch Bobby believed was there. But he meant to try. You could bet your watch and chain on that. Now he set his boot into a rope stirrup, slid the knot tight, and put the Snoopy radio in his shirt. "Let me down easy, Johnny." Enders began to turn a windlass, and Gardner began to slide downward. Beside him, the smooth gray hull slid up and up and up. If they wanted to get rid of him, this would be as easy a way as any, he supposed. Just send a telepathic order to Enders.
"Let go of the wheel, John. We're through with him."
And down he would plunge, 40 feet to the solid bedrock at the bottom, slack rope trailing up behind him. Crunch. But, of course, he was at their mercy anyhow, and he supposed they recognized his usefulness, however reluctantly. The Tremaine kid was young, strong as a bull, but he had fagged out in 2 days. Enders was going to last out today, maybe. But Gardner would have bet his watch and chain, what watch and chain, ha-ha, that there would be somebody else out here tomorrow to keep tabs on him.
Bobby was okay. Bullshit she was. If you hadn't come back, she would have killed herself. But she hung in there better than Enders or the Tremaine kid.
His mind returned inexorably.
Bobby went into the shed with the others. Tremaine and Enders never did, at least not that you ever saw. Maybe that's the difference. So what's in there, 10,000 angels dancing on the head of a pin? The ghost of James Dean, the Shroud of Turin, what?
He didn't know. His foot touched down at the bottom. "I'm down," he yelled. Ender's face, looking very small, appeared at the edge of the cut. Beyond, Gardner could see a tiny wedge of blue sky. Too tiny. Claustrophobia whispered in his ear, a voice as rough as sandpaper. The space between the side of the ship and the wall covered with that silvery netting was very narrow down here. Gardner had to move with great care to avoid touching the ship's side and setting off one of those brain bursts. The bedrock was very dark. He squatted and ran his fingers over it. They came away wet. They had come away a little wetter each day for the last week. That morning he had cut a small square, 4 inches on a side and a foot, into the floor of the bedrock, using a gadget that had once been a blow-dryer. Now he opened his toolkit, removed a flashlight, and shone the light into it. Water down there. He got to his feet and screamed, "Send down the hose!"
"What?"
drifted down. Ender sounded apologetic. Gardner sighed, wondering just how much longer he himself could hold out against the steady drag of exhaustion. All this Hugo Gernsback whole universe equipment, and no one thought to rig an intercom between up there and down here. Instead, they were screaming their throats out.
"Oh, but none of their bright ideas run in that direction, and you know it. Why would they think about intercoms when they can read thoughts? You're the horse and buggy human here, not them."
"The hose!" he shrieked. "Send down the motherfucking hose, tripe head!" "Okay." Gardner stood waiting for the hose to come down, wishing miserably that he was anywhere else in the world than here, wishing he could convince himself all of it was only a nightmare. It was no good. The ship was madly exotic, but this reality was also too prosy to be a dream. The acrid smell of John Ender's sweat, the slightly boozy smell of his own, the dig of the rope loop into his instep as he went down into the cut, the feel of rough, moist bedrock under his fingers.
"Where's Bobby Guard? Is she dead?"
No, he didn't think she was dead. But he had become convinced that she was desperately ill. Something had happened to her on Wednesday. Something had happened to all of them on Wednesday. Gardner could not quite bring his memories into focus, but he knew there had been no real blackout or DT nightmare. It would have been better for him if there had been. There had been some sort of cover-up last Wednesday, a frantic cut and paste. And in the course of it, he believed that Bobby had been hurt, taken ill, something.
"But they're not talking about it."
"Bobby Tremaine." "Bobby? Heck, Mr. Gardner, nothing wrong with Bobby. Just a little old heat stroke. She'll be back in no time. She can use the rest. You know that better than anyone, I guess." It sounded great. So great, you'd almost think the Tremaine kid believed it himself until you looked closely at his odd eyes. He could see himself going to those he was coming to think of as the shed people, demanding to know what had happened to her. Newt Beringer. "Next thing you know, he'll be trying to tell us that we're the Dallas police." And boy, they'd sure all start to laugh then, wouldn't they? Them, the Dallas police? That was pretty funny. That was a scream.
Maybe,
Guard thought.
That's why I feel so much like doing it. Screaming, I mean.
Now he stood deep in this man-made crack in the earth, a crack that contained a titanic alien flying ship, waiting for the hose to come down. And suddenly the final horrible passage of George Orwell's Animal Farm clanged in his head like a death cry. It was strange. The things you discovered you'd gotten by heart. Clover's old eyes flitted from one face to another. And as the animals outside looked from pig to man and man to pig and pig to man again, it seemed that some strange thing was happening. It was impossible to say which was which.
Jesus, Guard, cut it out.
End of side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over.